You're invited to the ultimate celebration this New Year's Eve across the ABC. Join Zan Rowe and Charlie Pickering, bringing you live music from the Sydney Harbour Stage, including Melanie C, Matt Corby, The Cat Empire, Peach PRC, Marsha Hines, Casey Donovan, Don West, Jem Casadaley, Aisha Madden, and more.
Absolutely huge.
And two spectacular fireworks displays to light up the night sky. Audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
Celebrate New Year and welcome in 2026 on ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. The federal government confirms plans for a gas reservation on the east coast, pledging the move will put downward pressure on prices. But will households benefit? You'll hear from Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen.
We're not saying this is a panacea or will fix all our problems, but we think Australians are right when they look at the situation that Australia is one of the world's largest gas producers and exporters, and yet we have forecast shortages and have had for 20 years.
Then, Aussie wine grape growers raise a glass to a new mandatory code of conduct, which many say is crucial for the survival of the industry. We speak with the CEO of Riverina Wine Grape Growers.
It was great to see the announcement yesterday from the government, but the devil will be in the detail.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Australia is one of the world's biggest liquefied natural gas exporters. But according to the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, East Coast gas supplies could fall well short of demand from 2028, despite there being sufficient reserves and resources for at least the next decade. Well, in a bid to prevent gas shortages and drive down energy bills, the federal government has announced gas producers on the East Coast will have to reserve a portion of gas they extract for local use. For more on this plan, host Barbara Miller spoke with Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen.
You say this scheme will put downward pressure, I'm quoting you there, on gas prices. Will prices actually drop?
Well, we're not saying this is a panacea or will fix all our problems, but we think Australians are right when they look at the situation that Australia is one of the world's largest gas producers and exporters, as you indicated, and yet we have forecast shortages and have had for 20 years forecast shortages, and it doesn't make any sense. Now, the policy that we announced yesterday, our preferred model, slightly oversupplies the Australian market, which is our best way of putting downward pressure on prices. Now, gas prices will be always determined by a range of fundamental factors. The cost of extraction, the gas in the Bass Strait, which is very cheap gas, is running out. There's only 12% of it left. We've been exporting that since the 1960s, and there's only 12% left. Gas to exploit in Queensland and Northern Territory is much more expensive to get out of the ground and to move around the country. These are fundamental factors, but nevertheless, the levers the federal government has are designed to put downward pressure on prices, and we pulled that lever yesterday.
So are you saying you can guarantee this will help address shortages, but you can't guarantee it will make a difference to household bills?
Well, I can guarantee it will address shortages, and I can guarantee it's the best way we have of putting downward pressure on prices as much as possible. Obviously, prices are an element of supply and demand. If you increase supply domestically, you're putting downward pressure on prices.
This only will apply to new contracts. Is its impact then pretty limited?
Well, it's a pretty important fundamental red line. We don't believe in ripping up contracts. We don't believe in creating sovereign risk. You know, yes, it would have been better if this policy was in place 20 years ago, but it wasn't. And the second best time is today. Now, that means, though, respecting those contracts that companies have entered into with countries like Japan and Taiwan and Korea and others. We want to be a reliable supplier. But contracts are starting to come off over the next few years. As early as 2027 and the international contracts in 2030 and beyond. So this is the best way we have. And the reason we did this yesterday was also to say to companies, any contracts you enter into from today, from yesterday, will be regarded as new and will therefore have to comply with the new rules.
You spoke to our key trading partners of gas. What was their response?
Yeah, I spent last week talking to my ministerial counterparts in key countries that buy gas from us. They appreciated the fact that this was prospective.
Aren't there infrastructure issues that will make it difficult to get this gas to the people you want to get to have it?
Yes, there are some challenges coming. We've got to get gas to where it's consumed in the southern parts of the country more and more. Energy ministers have been working together on a model to try and make sure that AEMO has the powers to deal with that. There are various models, whether it's gas pipelines or regasification terminals. But look, yeah, basically, energy ministers have been working together. Gas has got an important role to play as we transition to renewables. It's not the answer to all our problems, as the Liberal Party claims, nor can it have no role as the Greens play. Our approach is to ensure that we have enough gas to provide a sensible support mechanism as we move very quickly to a much more renewable system. But there are heavy industry users who one day might be able to use green hydrogen but can't yet. We need to support them. There are 5 million homes that use gas to heat their homes. Many of them are electrifying, but we are not electrifying as fast as the gas sources are depleting.
Well, you're also Minister for Climate Change. Isn't there a danger that this policy will slow the transition to renewables?
No, on the contrary, gas is a very important support for renewables. Gas-fired power stations, what I think is important to understand and remember is that they're very flexible. You can turn them on and you can turn them off with, you know, in some instances, 2 minutes' notice. That's not the case with coal. It's certainly not the case with nuclear. So if you've got a renewable system which might need a bit of support with what we call firming, for a few hours in the night, you can turn a gas-fired power station on. That's a very useful support to give Australians confidence as we transition to a much more renewable energy system.
Just turning to the aftermath of the Bondi attack now, and the opposition leader Susan Lee has been very critical of the Prime Minister, saying he's not spending enough time with victims. And yesterday, calling out Foreign Minister Penny Wong for, she said, not shedding a single tear. What's your response?
I thought that said more about Susan Lee than it does about Penny Wong. I thought that was a disgusting element of an increasingly partisan pile-on in the wake of a national crisis. Australia has in the past come together at moments like this, whether it be the Link Cafe or Port Arthur, and oppositions have chosen not to make political points. This opposition has chosen a different path, and to Susan Lee is not the arbiter of grief or mourning. She does not get to decide how people express that mourning and that grief. And I thought, as I said, it said more about Susan Lee than it does about Penny Wong. We have a government which is dealing with this crisis. We've got a Prime Minister who is a very empathetic man who has been spending time privately with victims and dealing with this crisis, and also enrolling National Security Committee meetings, talking to premiers and dealing with it at the same time as supporting victims and their families as they choose to be. He's not going to, you know, invite himself in where a family is dealing with grief, but where he can play a role, he has been. And Susan Lee, I think, needs to reflect on her behaviour yesterday. It was pretty disgusting, and I think it shows that she is choosing to make political points out of an issue and a personal attack on someone like Penny Wong, I think, will jar pretty badly with Australians.
Setting aside those particular comments, isn't the opposition, though, tapping into the sentiment of the community? We've seen the Prime Minister say he could have done more and that he wasn't perfect. Now he said, sorry. Has the opposition got a point that perhaps the Prime Minister has initially misread this?
I think the Prime Minister has reflected no government is perfect, no person is perfect, and he's indicated that we think more can be done, it will be done, and he's dealing with the biggest terrorist attack on Australian shores in Australian history. But let me be very clear, Barbara. There are two people responsible for this attack. One is dead and one is under arrest. And let's not have a political attack divert attention from that. The political attacks on the Prime Minister, the partisan pile-on on the Prime Minister by current and former members of the Liberal and National Party in Parliament has been a diversion from the fact that we've had two terrorists. Countries around the world, governments around the world have to deal with terrorism. ISIS inspired terrorism. Now, ISIS does not believe in the existence of any nation state, whether it be Israel or Palestine or Australia. They believe in a caliphate. That is not a rational approach, and we are not dealing with rational people when we're dealing with ISIS-inspired terrorism. Now, if Others think they could do a better job of dealing with that irrational terrorist ideology. Then that's a matter for them. This government has, we now have the strongest hate laws in Australian history, thanks to the Albanese government. The Abbott Turnbull Morrison government spent their time trying to water down our hate laws. They tried to abolish 18C, the Race Discrimination Act, which is the racial laws which stop humiliating, offending and insulting. They spent their entire time trying to water down those laws. Now they say they should be stronger. I mean, we didn't seek this partisan argument, but if they want to have a partisan argument, then the facts will be laid out as well.
Just on the issue of a royal commission, the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has said he'll conduct a state-based royal commission, and he says it would include federal agencies. Is it your understanding that a state-based inquiry could include ASIO and the AFP?
Well, the Prime Minister's indicated we'll cooperate and we will ask our agencies to respond. And, of course, the Prime Minister and the Premier are talking about that. We'll see the terms of reference of the New South Wales Royal Commission in due course. But, of course, the Commonwealth agencies will provide whatever cooperation they can to this state-based inquiry.
Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen there. Staying with federal politics and the government's response to the Bondi terror attack, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has defended his decision not to call a national royal commission into the deadly shooting, drawing sharp criticism from the opposition that shows no sign of abating. For his reaction, Barbara spoke to Andrew Wallace. He's the Shadow Attorney General.
Some fairly strong comments from the Minister for Climate Change and Energy there regarding Susan Lee's comments on Foreign Minister Penny Wong, saying they were disgusting and she needs to check her behaviour. What's your response?
Well, Barbara, I saw Susan in Sydney down at Bondi last week. Every day last week she was visiting the site. She was with community leaders, with people who have lost loved ones, people who have been injured in hospital. Susan is feeling the grief and pain that has been experienced by the Jewish community in Australia viscerally, because she's been immersed in that grief and pain. And I think Susan's comments yesterday were entirely appropriate. The government, the Prime Minister, needs to wake up to himself. This continued nothing to see here issue in relation to the Federal Royal Commission belies belief. What is the Prime Minister trying to hide? Why won't he announce a Federal Royal Commission which will look into all of these things? Now, I heard the Prime Minister yesterday say, oh, well, we don't want a state Royal Commission, we don't want an inquiry into the intelligence agencies and a Federal Royal Commission. Well, I agree with him, that would be silly. What we do want is one all-encompassing Federal Royal Commission which will look into the reasons that led to this massacre and the anti-Semitism that has been absolutely prevalent in this country particularly since the 7th of October 2023. Only a Federal Royal Commission can deal with all of these issues, including things like immigration, our counter-terrorism response, the connection between police, law enforcement, and our intelligence agencies. All of these things need to be looked at.
But how long would that take, Andrew Wallace? I mean, the Prime Minister has said his concern is that there needs to be a quick response. What you're outlining sounds like a very deep and long dive into many facets of Australian life and politics.
Well, I heard the Prime Minister yesterday also critique the draft terms of reference, which were put together by the Coalition yesterday and announced yesterday. This was Australia's worst terrorist event, a worst terrorist attack. And I make no apologies. The Coalition makes no apologies for putting together a very, very comprehensive and detailed terms of reference. Now, Royal Commissions inevitably take time. You can't quibble with that. But they are the preeminent form of inquiry in this country. And I cannot understand why the Prime Minister would not agree to a federal Royal Commission, which will look into all failings of state, territory and Commonwealth government departments and agencies. Only a federal Royal Commission. And it's not just me saying this, Barbara. We've got a former Chief Justice of the High Court coming out and saying this. We've got now 100 silks, senior barristers around the country who have signed an open letter saying that this is the only way that this should be dealt with. These are preeminent lawyers in this country. It's not just me. I know the Prime Minister may not want to listen to me. That's fair enough. But we've now got Peter Cosgrove, a former Governor General. We've even got Labor Party members, past and present, who are breaking ranks with the Prime Minister. What does the Prime Minister have to hide? Look, essentially what the Prime Minister, I think, is doing is he is limping to the 25th of December, hoping that this will all go away and the media will move on post 1st of January. Well, I've got news for the Prime Minister. I am going to be on the airwaves and on television and every other form of media banging on about the importance of a federal Royal Commission until he agrees to do it. And if he thinks the coalition is going to go quiet, I've got news for him.
Shadow Attorney General Andrew Wallace. As you heard at the start of this podcast, a domestic gas reservation scheme is on the way for Australia's east coast. The policy is aimed at putting what the government calls downward pressure on prices and to help alleviate looming gas shortages. For expert analysis of this policy, Barbara caught up with Danny Alexander, who is the CEO of the University of New South Wales's Energy Institute.
What's your sort of overall read of what was announced yesterday?
We're now starting to get the details of the domestic gas reservation scheme, showing that we're going to need to keep between 15 to 25% of our production for the Australian market. The date makes sense to me, given the Australian Energy Market Operator has forecast possible peak day gas shortages from 2028. If we see high winter demand for gas in our southern states at a time when gas production is also unexpectedly interrupted. You know, we're waiting to see the details of the scheme because they're not yet firm and they'll be settled by a consultation period next year, but the principles guiding the design have been published. The principle that most interests me is the principle of respecting existing export contracts to address what we've seen as possible perceptions of sovereign risk. This has been raised as an issue as the possibility of this scheme has been discussed previously because Australia is seen as having a relatively stable policy environment. If existing contracts were affected, we might not be seen as such a good place for energy investments into the future.
As you've said, it comes in 2027. Isn't there a high chance we'll see shortages before then?
The Australian Energy Market Operator has forecasted these peak day gas shortages from 2028, but it's only after that, from 2029 onwards, that they have forecast annual shortages. So the dates do make sense to me in that sense, but we should also consider not just the supply side, but the demand side. So we can also address the issues of shortages by, I guess, reducing our demand for gas, which, you know, in many cases means electrifying loads.
Is there a chance, though, that this policy will drive up demand?
I haven't seen that come through in the analysis, but what I do question is whether the policy will make it more difficult to electrify or build the business case for electrification. So what we'd really like to see is the government also focusing on addressing the demand side issue by incentivizing or facilitating a greater electrification, particularly of low value uses of gas, as an example, residential heating loads.
Well, green groups have mostly backed the proposal, but are cautioning that it can't be used as an excuse to develop more gas fields. Do you think that's a likely outcome?
The fact that this is only affecting new contracts will the reservation be enough to address the projected gas supply shortfall? Essentially, if it's only new contracts, we don't know how much gas will be reserved. However, I feel fairly confident that we should be able to achieve both our emissions reduction but also our energy affordability targets if we're able to essentially address the demand side alongside the supply.
Will this put downward pressure, as the government puts it, on
on prices, will households see a difference?
So the policy approach taken by the government is to increase supply in order to reduce the pressure on prices. So yes, it could work, but the design of the scheme is going to be very important. So for gas users, this is going to depend on various factors, including the amount of gas storage, particularly in the southern region, so it's available when users need it at those peak times. For electricity and gas-powered generation particularly, the picture is more complex, but the message is somewhat the same. We need to make sure that the gas is available when and where we need it. So analysis by our Collaboration on Energy and Environmental Markets at UNSW has shown that there's a very strong correlation with global gas prices and our electricity prices at home. And we saw this really clearly when the Ukraine war constrained global supply and it drove up energy prices, both gas and electricity. So if the domestic gas reservation scheme is going to help with this, it's going to need to deliver enough supply to address that peak electricity demand.
And are there infrastructure issues there with delivering that supply?
Yes, it's not just temporal, so the time, it's also locational that we need to consider. And there are actually some really interesting ways in which to solve this. So for instance, using our existing gas pipelines to bump up our storage capacity in those southern regions. But if we're to do those things, we're going to need to actually free up more capacity in those pipelines by doing things like reducing household gas demand, so electrifying more household appliances.
Danny Alexander, CEO of the University of New South Wales's Energy Institute there. To the vineyards now. Wine grape growers in Australia have campaigned for two decades for a code of conduct to regulate the sector. Now, the federal government has granted their wish, with a mandatory code to come into effect in January 2027. Amid warnings, the move may have come too late for some operators. Barbara spoke with Jeremy Cass, the CEO of Riverina Wine Grape Growers.
Tell me, Jeremy Cass, what is the state of the industry right now?
It's the worst it's been in living memory. And when I say living memory, we've got a grape grower in Riverina who's 90 years old and he's never seen it this bad ever.
Why then do you think it's taken so long for this code to come about?
That is a good question. It's a million-dollar question, and I think if anyone had the answers, we would have fixed the whole thing by now. So, you know, I think the fact that it has come to fruition is a great thing. It's a bit disappointing that we won't see it in action for this vintage. It's just about to start. We've got to wait another 12 months. And it was great to see the announcement yesterday from the government, but the devil will be in the detail. And we wait to see whether they've taken the full recommendations that Craig Emerson put before them or whether they've watered them down or how they're going to go about, you know, the two main pillars that we're resting on up here are early indicator prices and terms of payment, which would rectify the whole problem of some of the outlying wineries that sort of don't comply. You know, we've had signatories to the voluntary code and they've done a really good job and they're, you know, continuing to do so. But it's the ones that haven't signed up that, you know, are treating growers poorly, especially in these tough times, are the reason we need it.
Spell out for us what those two pillars, the impact of those policies and what you hope from this code.
Yeah, well, there's a whole heap more recommendations as well, but those two are the main two that we're looking at because it then gives growers, if you get early indicator prices, a chance to actually make decisions on whether you keep investing in growing grapes or remove them or abandon them or even basically just try and rest them for a year and minimise your inputs. And the other one, terms of payment would stop wineries who pay 10 payments over a period of 12 months, which, you know, you means you get, especially when you're getting low, below cost of production costs, it means that, you know, growers have tried to try and find a way to pay their bills and they're not going to get fully paid for that crop until they've delivered the next one.
Why did things get so bad, do you think? Why has this situation been worsening for growers?
Well, there's a number of reasons there, and I think that, you know, we've got a global contraction of consumption of wine and probably all alcohol for that matter, because of the wellness industry. You've got the World Health Organization suggesting that any alcohol can cause cancer, which doesn't do you any favours. You've got different generations that are choosing a healthier option, and, you know, all of those things are great, but it just means that we've got to restructure the industry to meet that. And the unfortunate part of that is our restructure was rushed upon us by the Chinese tariffs that came in when Scott Morrison challenged China over COVID. And that threw us into a world of hurt that, you know, made us hit the wall a long time before we should have, and allowed us no time to transition. And that's why we've been asking for government assistance for some time.
What more would you like to see done?
I think, you know, we've got to let supply and demand come into play, and for that to happen properly at the moment, it's fundamentally broken because of the oversupply. It'd be great to see a one-off buyback of wine just to get that ageing wine out of the system so it's not depressing the market.
Jeremy Cass, the CEO of Riverina Wine Grape Growers there. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Barbara Miller and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Kathy Niven and Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you the same time tomorrow.